Direction point. Direction point.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations, put out by Target Books from 1973 onward, in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. Happy holidays from New York City, where, like all New Yorkers, I was nowhere near the ball drop in Times Square, but instead attending a party at my kid's friend's apartment, or my kid's friend's parents' apartment, in Park Slope. Now, ordinarily, you bring your kid along to parties. You don't have your kid drag you to her parties, but this is the life we lead in 21st century Brooklyn. For the new year, 2024, the fourth calendar year of this podcast, I am off Twitter, presumably forever, absent some change in management or content moderation policy. You can find me on Blue Sky, that Doctor Who Novels, Dr. Who Novels. That is going to be my primary fandom social media outlet for the foreseeable future. And you can also find us as a YouTube channel at Doctor Who Novels, Dr. Who Novels, with all past episodes of the show up for your viewing, or in this case, listening pleasure, as this is still an audio-only show. Some content is blocked in certain countries, usually musical cues, but that should not affect most of my viewers in North America, or the British Isles, or Western Europe. You can also find me at the Gallifrey One convention in Los Angeles in about 6 weeks, where I again hope to record enough material to bring you two or three live episodes. If you are a listener of the show and you have not spoken to me personally before, come over and say hi if you see me. I should be on a couple of panels, and there usually is a podcasters meetup over the weekend where I will be present, hopefully with some Doctor Who literature swag. You can catch me on several other podcasts that have dropped lately. I have been on several recent episodes of Trap One, covering two of the recent RTD2 era specials, also covering the Season 20 collection, Blu-ray box set, a couple of Trap One books related episodes. I am also featured on Reality Bomb, their recent two-part 20 Essential Elements of Doctor Who series. I can be heard in the second of those episodes, released in time for Doctor Who's 60th anniversary in November 2023. Meanwhile, as 2024 kicks off, we return to the Target books, and we're well past the halfway point of the original run. Today, book number 99, The Crotons, with longtime friend and now co-producer of the show, the great Jim Sangster. Today, on Doctor Who Literature, let's get to it.
Direction point. Why didn't you download Google Maps like I told you to? I couldn't remember the Wi-Fi password. It's the same as it always is. Crystal with a K. I thought it needed a special character. We've got Philip Maddock playing Elec. That's special enough for you.
This is Tim Treloar.
This is David J. Howe.
I'm Peter Purvis.
I am Sadie Miller.
This is Lauren Cornelius.
Larry, it's Fraser.
For all things in the Doctor Who collecting world and beyond, the Doctor Who Collectors Podcast. I'm Larry Van Mersburg and your host, and I've been collecting for 42 years. You're listening to Doctor Who Literature on the Direction Point Podcast Network. Keep turning the pages.
Marvelous. Hello.
All right, Jim Sangster, welcome back to your first of many episodes of Doctor Who Literature in the next 2 months. You're almost going to be my permanent guest host for the next few weeks.
I was going to start off with, hello.
I am not in the headspace to do any arpeggios right now, but I've never been good at doing a Neil Patrick Harris impression.
Well, I'm not dancing and I'm not covering myself in rose petals because that would just be silly, but I do have all the joys of having enjoyed all three of the specials, so I'm in a very, very good mood for Doctor Who. I appreciate that, but at the time that we're recording this, the specials are still news, whereas by the time this comes out, we'll have already seen the first proper Shuti Gatwa full episode, won't we?
That's right. We are recording this 8 days before House on Ruby Road drops, and by House on Ruby Road, I mean Church on Ruby Road. And then I'll be doing possibly a mini episode of Doctor Who Literature with my kid as my special guest. But I say that in the future, by the time this episode drops, if I recorded that, it will have already aired. So we're doing this in a wibbly-wobbly, squirmy-wormy, out-of-order sequence. And I will also be moderating the Trap 1 panel on Church on Ruby Road. So by the time the audience hears this, I will have already talked about the Christmas special twice on two different podcasts.
You'll have already registered your disgust on the internet. So
I'm hoping that it's not disgust. I had very specific thoughts and feelings about the return of RTD, but I am hopeful that there's going to be a clean slate and a whole new style. I mean, look at the novelization for Church on Ruby Road. It's a hardcover book, doesn't have the Target logo, doesn't have the Anthony Dry cover illustration style. It's got a spectacular full-color painting by Lee Binding. It's a new author. It's a young author. It's an international author. So we're going in a very different direction, I feel, with Church on Ruby Road. I feel it's going to be a whole different kind of Doctor Who that we've never seen before. And after 3 weeks of exploring the past, perhaps in excessive detail, I am ready for something brand and entirely new, and that's what I'm hoping for.
I mean, we've been chatting today about my revelations when it came to the most recent episode that we've seen, The Giggle, and the supposedly brand new thing of bi-generation. And I admit it took me a week to work it out that we've already had bi-generation in Doctor Who, haven't we? In Planet of the Spiders, we had Campo and Shoji, who are, it's one Time Lord living two lives simultaneously in retirement. And I thought, that's great, we've already had it. And then my mate Craig Williams sent me a screen grab of Troughton's last moments in the War Games, where we see him splitting into three, and it's like, what, tri-generation? We've had it since 1969? That's amazing. And then I was thinking, that means that one of them became Pertwee, one of them went off and did season 6B as an agent for the Time Lords, and one of them in the pages of TV comic became a TV personality before he was kidnapped by the Scarecrows. So by inventing this thing and taking us back to something that's already been established in Doctor Who, even though none of us realized it at the time, a lot of extended Doctor Who universe has just become kind of canonical. So I think that's brilliant. I'm really happy with that.
And when I covered my top 60 Doctor Who's of all time, Logopolis at number one also features a bi-generation, because the events of that story are so traumatic that the Watcher, the Fifth Doctor, is born before the Fourth Doctor dies and is able to interact with the Fourth Doctor and is corporeal enough to steal the TARDIS and disconnect the entire coordinate subsystem. So the Watcher, Shoji, the multiple Second Doctor faces at the end of War Games, this whole bi-generation thing is not new information.
And then we realized that the first Doctor in the Five Doctors is clearly a bi-generated first Doctor who's having a nice little retirement in a garden. The Curator, you know, the whole idea of this really is that for the first time ever, at least in the UK, we've got adventures of every single Doctor available on iPlayer now. So Russell's idea of the Doctor, whichever Doctor you like, is always present and they're always out there in the universe. So there are going to be kids who discover Doctor Who for the first time, hopefully, with Shuti. And if they're like we were, and they're hungry for more, they can go and discover all these old ones, and those old ones will always be alive. They'll always be present, which I think is a beautiful, this whole thing of the Hooniverse is a beautiful idea. Where for the first time ever, it's not like when I was a kid, when I had to walk all the way to the library and I could only take out two books at a time. And then I had to wait until I was 10 and three quarters before they put old Doctor Who on the telly. Now I can just click up iPlayer and watch almost, with one notable exception, almost every single surviving story.
Which means that it's time to play Pluto, because on my phone I have the Pluto app, and Pluto has a Doctor Who channel 24 hours a day. So for a while on this podcast, I was turning on Pluto on Saturday night while doing my recording and doing an instant review of whatever classic series episode and part was screening on Pluto at that moment. I am now going to call up the Doctor Who channel on my phone, and I will show you whatever Pluto is playing, and you will tell me the story name and episode part. Of course, it's in the middle of a commercial break right now, but when it comes back, I will expect you to be able to tell me what we are looking at.
A commercial break? Oh, it must be the TV movie. That's the only one with... Oh, let's have a look. Oh, you're... Is that a Power Ranger?
It's a commercial for the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. The problem is I have my Zoom background turned on. And the irony is, as we are talking about how much I am looking for something new, my Zoom background is the Season 11 John Pertwee opening credit tunnel sequence.
That's so, okay. My T-shirt is it's not the right story that we're talking about, but it's a digital painting I did of Abominable Snowmen, which I put on a T-shirt.
My T-shirt is from a 1959 episode of The Twilight Zone. It's Burgess Meredith's glasses. Time enough at last.
Well, hopefully you'll get enough time to read all of these books. there we go.
There's three new novelizations coming. Oh, here we are.
Oh, it's the Vervoid episode. In fact, it's episode, is that two? Episode one or two of the Vervoids?
It's definitely
so
a
that's
Vervoid.
Episode 10, probably, of one of the few. As I said last time we spoke, I'm not very good at quoting, but the Trial of a Time Lord is one of the few stories that I know a ridiculous amount of dialogue from.
And you appeared on the DVD bonus features for Trial of a Time Lord. This is episode two, I believe, because it's the Doctor and Mel in the hydroponic bay talking to the Commodore with somebody's shoe. That looks like it's episode two of Vervoids.
Yeah, yeah. Which we'll hopefully be talking about properly next year.
That's right. All those books are coming up in sequence. Pluto informs me that is, in fact, episode one of Vervoid, so part nine of Trial of a Time Lord. But yes, it is amazing that not only does Pluto on my phone show me Doctor Who whenever I want, and it's almost always Trial of a Time Lord, by the way, we also now have on Tubi, which is an app that I use daily. That's how I'm watching Dark Shadows two a day. Tubi also now has the same classic series package, including many of the animations. So when you turn on Tubi, there's seven different tiles, one for each Doctor. And the Hartnell tile has the Galaxy 4 animation, and the Troughton tile has most of the animations. And you can watch everything from the Daleks Episode 1 through Survival Part 3, minus the unanimated stories on Tubi, as well as watching on Pluto. So, yeah, Doctor Who on your phone, whenever you want it, is a wonderful thing.
It's magnificent, isn't it? It's as I said, the joy of watching just five old stories when I was 10, and that sent me into craziness, otherwise known as fandom. that is the thing that I think a lot of people my age in the UK say, that's where I tipped over. I was reading the books, I was buying the weekly comic, but then I saw William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton and John Pertwee and thought, they're amazing. Especially when the three of them come together. the strange thing of, I was too young to know that like the Crotons isn't supposed to be one of the good ones, because I was old enough to know they're all good ones. There's no such thing as a bad one. Why are people moaning about it? And it wasn't until the end of that year that Doctor Who Monthly did the special about the archives, where we discovered, as I mentioned last time, that they don't even have all of the John Pertwee stories, never mind all of the black and white ones. So then you realize that the rarity of four-parters in Troughton and the rarity of surviving stories means that the Crotons is literally the only four-part story they can show. So I was grateful. I didn't care. Me and my best mate were watching it and were so excited that we got to see Patrick Troughton, or as he insisted on calling him, Patrick Troughton. We're back to the Don Houghton, Don Horton discussion from last time as well.
Yes, I released two Don Houghton episodes within a month of each other, the Inferno and Mind of Evil books, and I called him Houghton on one and Houghton on the other. So if you're listening to this podcast in publication order, you're wondering why Don Houghton's name regenerated, or if you will, bigenerated, in between episodes 89 and 94 or whatever it was. So I'll give you my Troughton origin story real quick. My first Doctor Who convention was July 27th, 1985 in Manhattan. And this was right after America had purchased for various PBS stations the Hartnell and Troughton surviving packages. 17 Hartnell serials, 5 Troughton serials. At the convention, they screened a 6-part omnibus of Dalek Invasion of Earth and a 6-part omnibus of The Seeds of Death. I was there at age 11 and a half with my father. He was not staying all night so I could watch 4 and a half hours of Doctor Who movies. We left after Dalek Invasion of Earth, so I did not get to see Seeds of Death, but I did buy the War Games novelization in the dealer's room. 2 months later, the New Jersey PBS station started airing the full Hartnell Troughton package, but it was accompanied by a bespoke made-for-PBS documentary called Doctors Who Old and New. And it was two of their commentators talking about the fact that they now had the Hartnell package and the Troughton package and season 22. So they showed clips from Unearthly Child, the 1-minute clip from part 3. They showed a 1-minute clip from part 4 of the Crotons, and then they showed a clip from whatever season 22 story they wanted to advertise. So starting in September, every Saturday night, it was one of the 17 Hartnells in order, one of the 5 Troughtons in order, but the last week of the month, they would show one season 22 story every month. So you would have a break in between Hartnell and Troughton to watch something from season 22. So for a good 6-month stretch, it was just either the oldest available Doctors or the newest available Doctor, channeling late 1985 into early 1986. As you heard from my Invasion episode, I bought this book in December 1985, literally 38 years ago this month. And when I was watching The Mind Robber shortly after buying this book, I recognize that sort of cell structure background behind the Croton because it also appears as a backdrop in The Land of Fiction. I was perhaps the only 12-year-old on planet Earth who was excited to watch The Mind Robber because it contained a bit of scenery from a story that I had read but had not seen yet. That's probably the saddest Doctor Who memory that I can tell you. But before The Mind Robber and before the Crotons, I had to sit through The Dominators first, and that didn't take, as you may be aware from hearing other episodes of this show. The Mind Robber I loved to pieces, the Crotons I really enjoyed, Seeds of Death I missed, and then the War Games I really enjoyed. So my initial Troughton experience was a very, very positive one, but this was several years after you and the 5 Faces of Doctor Who season.
And sorry, Fraser. I think season 6, well, season 6 is my favourite. If I say favourite, then no one can argue with me. Season 6 is my favourite Troughton of the three, even though it has two of my least favourite stories. So I'm not a Dominators apologist. There's bits of it I quite like. And then The Space Pirates, I think, is potentially a contender for the worst black and white story and one of the top three worst stories of all time, of the classic era. But a bit like with Enemy of the World, where as soon as we could see it and we suddenly discovered an entirely new dimension, maybe there's something in the visuals of the space pirates which we're not aware of, and maybe I'd enjoy it if it was ever returned. So it's not like there's any missing story where I'd say, oh, I don't want to see it. Because to see, even though in The Space Pirates we get less Troughton and Fraser Hines and Wendy Padbury than we normally would, because they're too busy ramping up for the war games. Even just to see some more of them would still be great. But even though I think the war games and the invasion are probably the best of the bunch, I still love the Crotons for just being the first Traum story I saw all the way through. But then I also love the fact that it's got a great soundtrack, a really unusual, eerie soundtrack. And maybe the design of the Crotons isn't the most impressive, but it's about on par with a lot of other stuff that isn't a Dalek or a Cyberman in Doctor Who of that era. But the voices are something completely unique, completely alien and terrifying. Sometimes people say, oh, they were being framed as a challenger for the Daleks. I don't think anyone in any good conscience thought that. But I do think that the voice is very distinctive and would be terrifying if you heard it blasting out of speakers out of nowhere in your school.
There's probably a bi-generated Patrick Troughton Doctor in season 9 in Day of the Crotons, where the Crotons invade Earth in the 22nd century, and one of their slaves rebels and travels back in time to the 20th century and accidentally starts the World War III that allows the Crotons to invade. And then, of course, later on in bi-generated Troughton season 10 or season 11, you have a story where the TARDIS lands on a planet and there's 10,000 Crotons frozen in an ice cano, and they all shatter into a million pieces because crystals don't perform very well when frozen.
This would only really work if Croton mania had happened in the aftermath of with Louis Marks wind up Crotons going across the desktop. That'd be how far can we push this?
The point is that, not counting the Five Doctors, which I did see first, the first bit of live black and white Troughton that I ever saw would have been that 1 60-second clip from part 4 of the Crotons that aired in this PBS special in late 1985 in New Jersey. I don't know if that special is now available on YouTube, but I probably have the whole thing memorized even after all this time. But I am very fond of the Crotons because I saw that clip first, and it's the Doctor and Zoe in the Dynatrope stalling for time so the anti-Croton sludge can take effect. It's a very funny scene, and it's, you know, Patrick Troughton and Wendy Padbury at their best. But I've got to go off the boards for a moment. I want to speak up in defense of the space pirates. The problem the space pirates has is that the Doctor doesn't.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. I think we've lost you. Oh no, that's a shame.
Well, I will be doing a space.
Fraser, come back. You're forgiven. Jason's gone crazy. No, sorry, that's terribly rude. You carry on. I do apologize.
The problem is that the TARDIS doesn't show up until 17 minutes into part 1, and they don't meet any other guest characters until part 3, and they're not even in studio for part 6. It was the first Doctor Who story since Mission of the Unknown that was done in studio without any regulars in it. So they're only in half the story. It is a comedy western, and there are some, depending on your tolerance of Milo Clancy, there are some bits that are meant to be amusing. It is not meant to be a boring, slow-moving space opera. It's supposed to be a fast-paced western comedy. And it's kind of caught between these two conflicting forces to imitate 2001 A Space Odyssey and let Robert Holmes be funny. There is a good story in there waiting to get out. The story that we get is not that good story, but you can see the outline of a better story in there.
And as we often say, Doctor Who can do any type of genre, any type of story, except westerns and pirates. So a story that does space pirates is onto a hiding to nothing. So
it's funny because looking ahead on my calendar, I have you down for another Doctor Who western in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, but that's actually a good one, despite what everyone says.
All right, so let's get back to the Crotons, having exhausted my audience's patience by talking about everything else. I did, like a dangerous person on the internet, I did my research, and I came up with two. The peanut gallery back here heard me say I'm doing my research, and they said, oh boy. I came up with two facts about the Crotons that I want to share with you. Number one, Robert Holmes used to be a policeman. And number two, The Crotons is a direct reference to the student riots in Paris of 1968. So Robert Holmes, the former Law and Order cop, hated these rebellious left-wing students and wanted to write a story trashing them. This is what I learned about the Crotons, having done my research. Prove me wrong.
We've spoken in the past about people who, well, I've done my own research, haven't we? And so have I. There are a lot of fan biographies that talk about Robert Holmes, and they inevitably say, yeah, he was in the army and he was a police officer. And I'll be honest with you, until I read Richard Molesworth's book, I had this impression of Robert Holmes being an authoritarian, and certain viewpoints that he's put forward in some of his stories, I thought were possibly a product of him being a police officer. But a friend of this show is an ex-police officer and is not exactly the most right-wing person we can imagine, Andrew Smith. And when I was looking into the history of Robert Holmes, yeah, it's true that he rushed to sign up to the army at the end of World War II. He was 16 and a half. So he was about a year and a half underage, and he lied to get in. And as a consequence of that, he was a commissioned officer at a very young age. The legend tends to aggrandize him as the youngest ever commissioned officer, which I'm not sure is verifiable. But also his rank was subaltern, which is literally the lowest rank you can be above cadet. It's just below a lieutenant and below a captain. But I asked my dad about this, and my dad was, he was in the army in the late 50s. So he wasn't in national service. He was an enlisted soldier. And when I said that Robert Holmes had been in Burma, my dad just gasped and went, that was rough. That was a rough campaign. So he's between the age of 16 and 19 in one of the worst battles in World War II. In very difficult situations.
There's two war movies in the 40s that are semi-Doctor Who adjacent, both taking place at the end of the Burma campaign. You have The Hasty Heart, starring Richard Todd from Kinda, and some guy named Ronald Reagan, of whom I don't know what happened to him. And then you have Peter R. Newman's Yesterday's Enemy, which is also in Burma. And it's interesting that this is a very large part of the World War II psyche, Burma, because all these movies came out about it, exploring the wounds of that war and what it did to the soldiers. And here we are talking about the same thing now with regard to Robert Holmes. I find that fascinating. Sorry for the interruption.
No. But then he, after 3 years, because you sign up for periods of 3 years, and then he decides he's had enough, and he joins the Metropolitan Police Force. He's stationed at Bow Street, which is in central London. It's roughly the area that we see in The Web of Fear, funny enough. And the legend again goes that he became fascinated by news reporters when he was given evidence in court. And that sparked his interest in becoming a writer. In truth, he was only a police officer for a year. So he wasn't this hardened establishment figure that I'd always imagined. He is a creative writer for most of his adult life. And I mean, he leaves the police force at about the age of 22, 23?
Oh.
Max. No, younger than that, maybe 21.
Wow.
So he's a journalist by the age of about 21, and he's writing for local newspapers. I think he joined the Press Association, so then he became a national writer. And then he got a chance to try out to write for TV in the late 50s. So here's another bit of myth busting, by the way. A lot of the people who just skim through his credits and they see he did a show called Knight Errant 59 and Harper's West 1. He did 50 episodes of Emergency Ward 10, Dr. Finney's Casebook, No Hiding Place, which is a police drama. And a lot of the biographies also lump in Dixon of Dock Green because people think, oh, that was in the 50s. It must have been at the same time. Actually, he didn't do Dixon of Dock Green until the mid-70s.
Oh, wow. So after many of his Doctor Who's even.
Yeah. So it was immediately before he took over as script editor on Doctor Who. And he has a little one episode stint on Dixon of Dock Green. The very beginning of Dixon of Dock Green. And I don't know if you even know this, but it's a show about regeneration in that the lead character, George Dixon. Is it George Dixon? Anyway, Dixon appears in a movie called The Blue Lamp, in which he's shot dead by Dirk Bogarde. And then the creator of the show went, I think I can resurrect him. So they just bring him back, and they have this massively long-running TV show for over 20-odd years. And the first bulk of scripts were written by one man. So there wasn't really room for Bob Holmes to step in there. But when Bob is an established writer, and by that time it got loads of different writers writing for the show, so that's when he's writing for Dixon and Doc Green in 1974. But one other lovely little thing, I saw this last week. There's a little bit of a dispute about who actually authored this, but there's a film called Invasion from 1965. And it stars Edward Judd. And if you watch it, you'll be thinking, watching it with story by Robert Holmes. So somebody else takes the screenwriting credit, but it's story by Robert Holmes. And as it starts playing out, and you find an alien who's found in the woods and taken to a local cottage hospital, where a blood specialist comes into the ward furious because someone's playing a prank on her, because this is not human blood. She takes a sample herself and realizes this isn't human blood. And you're thinking, this is just Spearhead from Space. Mm. And when you think about the fact that Bob Holmes was not afraid to recycle his own ideas, and we're looking at his very first Doctor Who story here now, The Crotons, which is actually a plot that he submitted in around about this time, actually, in 1965. He submitted to the BBC. The BBC says, we don't really have a home for four-part science fiction things like this. We tend to do them within the framework of a TV show. And we've got Out of the Unknown, which is an anthology show of hour-long episodes, usually televising established authors, so established sci-fi authors. So there's not really a home that would fit the trap, as it later became known, or the space trap. And Doctor Who, well, they've just, because they're alternating between science fiction and historical, they don't really have a lot of options, especially when Donald Tosh has just been told that 12 of his episodes are going to be dedicated to a Dalek story, just to appease one of the high ups in the BBC. So by the time he gets his rejection letter, Bob Holmes is already writing for Public Eye, an ITV detective serial. Sadly, none of those episodes survive, by the way. So he kind of forgets about it. And then 3 years later, he chances his arm and submits a script to the Doctor Who office again, or submits a storyline to the Doctor Who office again. But this time he's got Terence Dicks. And that's the beginning of something really magical. And I love this particular thing because, I'm sorry to just waffle on, but Terence Dix gets a job as an assistant deputy script editor. He's the lowest one in the office. But he's the only one who's sober. Because
I was going to say, where were Derek Sherwin and Peter Bryant as the script comes in over the transom? Had they been there, Robert Holmes might never have happened on Doctor Who.
Well, my guess is they were in the BBC Club or the Defector's Weld on Shepherd's Bush Green. Because when I worked near to TV Centre, that's where we always ended up for leave and do's. So it was a BBC bar on Shepherd's Bush Green. When Terence Dix arranges a meeting with, I think it was Derek Sherwin, it's said to have happened in a public house. So even then, Derek Sherwin is getting Bob Holmes to pitch his ideas to him. And apparently Bob Holmes is a very affable man. And Derek Sherwin goes from being very unimpressed and not seeing the potential of this script to suddenly, oh, well, go on, Terence, you go off and have this as your pet project. We're busy doing the real scripts. You can just get some practice in nurturing all of this. Of course, because the producer and the script editor are pissed the whole time. they are really struggling with scripts. They're burning up scripts like mad.
The Prison in Space,
which is awful. And then you've got the Queen of Time, a sequel to The Celestial Toymaker, which is abandoned to being practical, and they do The Seeds of Death instead. There's another one, I think, called The Dream Weavers or something like that. But there are loads of scripts they're burning through and just not being able to get anything to land. And in the end, they've got this script from Robert Holmes, which is, it's not great. David Maloney says he wasn't very impressed with it. Fraser Hines wasn't that impressed with it. But it's producible. And that's something that very few writers have been able to achieve at this point in time with the script editor and producer that they've got.
So I got to jump in with a few comments here. Number one, a lot of the success of the Crotons is down to the performance of the three regulars. Would Robert Holmes have been savvy enough about the program to write all the material about the Doctor and Zoe trying to one up each other, which is a running theme throughout the story? Or would that have been added by Terrence Dix? Because I'll point out that when it comes to the Seeds of Death, parts 1, 2, and 3 are terrible, and then Terrence Dix rewrites the back half and the story suddenly becomes lively. So you have to wonder if this was not maybe an uncredited Terrence Dix rewrite on top of Robert Holmes's draft to punch up the characters.
It's very possible. I mean, the plot of the second synopsis is very close to what we get on screen. So the structure of the story is there. It's possible Terrence Dix was beefing up the dialogue, but the actions and the drive of the story is all there. I think the only major change, apart from one character name changing, is the Dynatron, as it was in the storyline, is sent out into space where it blows up. And they realize a very cheap way of doing the same thing is to just pour some solvents onto some polystyrene and make it look like the Dinotrope is melting. But the structure is all there. So it's possible. It's possible. But also, I think one thing we've always said is that Robert Holmes has a real skill for dialogue. And the more he gets used to the show, the better he gets at it. Even in The Space Pirates, there's some really fun dialogue. There you go. I've said something nice about The Space Pirates.
Now give
me a sandwich.
Did you bi-generate in the middle of the podcast and I'm not speaking to alternate Jim?
It's anything's possible, isn't it? You know.
And I got to come back to Jack Warner for a moment. I will say that I've never seen The Blue Lamp and I've never seen a full episode of Dixon of Doc Green, but having watched Ashes to Ashes, I know the last scene of Ashes to Ashes is a clip from Dixon of Doc Green talking direct to the camera, because in the Ashes to Ashes verse, the Life on Mars verse, that's where Dixon ends up.
Yeah. That's one of the most incredible, one of the most incredible endings to a TV show ever. It's funny though, because Dixon of Doc Green was seen as really parochial and cozy, even though it was born out of his character being murdered by Dixon. Whenever they had breaks in the season, Dixon would actually address the audience and say, "Oh, you won't see me on my patrol next week. I'm going on a little holiday." He'd actually address the fact that they're not going to be on the air for a few weeks, and so that the viewers would be reassured with his, you know, cozy. And then you get in 61, I think, Z-Cars, which is entirely a reaction against the coziness of Dixon Doc Green. But then by the late 60s, Z-Cars is seen as a bit cozy. So the BBC's got these two cozy shows. And so they do a slightly tougher version of Z-Cars called Softly, Softly. And a lot of the casts that we're going to see in Doctor Who in the late 60s and early 70s have been in either Z-Cars or Softly, Softly. Also, the writers and the directors are getting trained on these shows and coming in and out of Doctor Who as well.
And we'll talk about Z-Cars when we do our Season 3 special, because Z-Cars might have been a component of Episode 7, the Christmas special, in the middle of Dalek's master plan. But that, of course, did not come to pass until the novelization.
I mean, I don't think it ever would have, to be honest, but because they just didn't do that kind of cross-pollination except in... actually, they didn't. They didn't do that cross-pollination at all. So you wouldn't get that. Maybe you get a little comedy review for a variety show at Christmas, but Doctor Who was still not commanding that kind of respect at the BBC. But yeah, I mean, as well as Doctor Who, I do love my police procedurals, so... This is something I've actually been talking head on TV about, whereas I've only done DVDs for Doctor Who. I've actually been on proper television talking about police procedurals.
My only knowledge of Jack Warner, though, comes from one film that my family would watch every Christmas. We don't celebrate the holiday, but we would watch the 1950 Alistair Sim version, Scrooge, of A Christmas Carol, which features a very meaty part Jack Warner invented for that movie and not part of the original Dickens, where Jack Warner plays this villainous character, and it's very, very opposite what he was playing as Dixon. It must have been a very fun role for him to play in this one short little movie, which is now widely regarded as the best version of Christmas Carol ever and still has sort of like this eternal afterlife 80 years later.
It's a shame that this is coming out after Christmas, because that'll be a good lead into discussion of Christmas. But you know what? I don't think I've seen that since I was a child, and I don't remember the part.
My family watched it every year growing up, so I have large portions of the film memorized. So yeah, that's a whole other podcast where we can discuss that. I think it was Marcus Hearn who did the audio commentary on the DVD of that version of Scrooge, so he may have gotten into it as well. I have that buried in a box somewhere. That's a movie well worth talking about, but we are here to talk about The Crotons, so let's finish our discussion. So speaking of having done my own research for this very special episode on The Crotons, Jim, I have it on good authority that you wrote a review of The Crotons for InVision magazine way back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. It was probably the very first published fan writing I did was a review of the Target Book of the Awakening, where I moaned about it just being padded, and it was, but I was just at the point when so this would have been maybe 1994 possibly. And I started traveling down from Liverpool to the tavern where everyone in London would meet up once a month. And I got to know Anthony Brown, who, I have to say, Anthony has always been the greatest sponsor of giving people a go, allowing people to have a go. And he used some of my artwork on InVision, and he also let me review a couple of the stories. And just for fun, he did a review of The Five Faces, and I got to do The Crotons. I've just been looking back at what I said at the time, and you can tell that I've just come out of university. I think I'm talking about the code to understanding the Crotons is that the dictators can lie dormant for centuries, safe in the knowledge that nothing will awaken the masses to their roles as wheels in the machine of their own servitude. Basically, I'm a little commie there, aren't I? I'm a little budding Marxist.
Well, the 2024 upcoming presidential election in the States has a lot of similarities with your 30-year-old review of The Crotons. But I think a larger point is The Crotons as a story doesn't necessarily need a code to unlock it. This is not necessarily a complex script with a lot of subtext. Which brings us to the point about the student riots in Paris in 1968. Is collective fan wisdom correct in assuming that this story, which was first pitched in 1965, is a direct reaction to heartbreaking current events?
Well, when I wrote my review, Anthony Brown, under a pen name, actually had to beef it up, because I had no knowledge of the Paris 68 riots. I knew nothing about it. So he added in a little bit of that as context. And I've always been a little bit cynical, thinking, oh, I'm sure he's overplaying that hand. But I think he's probably got a point. I think he really does. When you think about, like, in 1968, the revolution was in the air, and it rises up in cities, in centers of culture and education, you know, like universities, like learning halls. And all over the world, you've got Berkeley, New York, London, West Germany, Prague. The Prague Spring with revolution, and it looks like it might see a whole section of the Soviet Union split apart from Russia's control. And it's led by politically awakened youths who look to the previous generation and find them lacking. The old establishment has dragged youth into two world wars, and then we've had Korea, and now we've got Vietnam, and there's the constant threat of atomic Armageddon for like 20 years. All to fight the Red Menace, which, funnily enough, starts becoming quite attractive to the youth, because communism and socialism is a reaction against this authoritarian establishment that they feel is dragging humanity down. So there's a reason Che Guevara is the icon for the counterculture at this time, and for many years later, because he's young, he's idealistic, and he's good looking. He looks smashing on a T-shirt or a poster, you know, on a college wall. But also, his ideas felt like they might actually lead to change, because it's not just perpetuating the same thing. So I'm trying to do this without it becoming a sort of a TED talk about history, but I'm trying to make it as Doctor Who-y as possible. So Let's see how I can do with this. Because my first thought is, by 1968, there's a massive rise in global media. You know, we might think of the internet now, but by 1968, that was really a huge thing. Television makes all of this immediate. You know, the white heat of technology, the race to the moon, protests, coffins coming back from Vietnam. And then we might remember how Troughton, more than any other doctor, is framed within a TV screen in almost every story in season six. In The Crotons, you know, you see his face on the Dynatrope TV monitor. It's a surprise that he doesn't tap on the screen and go, "Jamie, don't forget to click below and subscribe to the official Doctor Who YouTube channel." and in TV comic, you know, he becomes a TV personality with that tri-generation splinter. And of course, when we see him on the monitor in The Five Doctors calling the Capitol, he's on TV. Troughton, more than any of them, is like he's framed within TV all the time. And that's because TV is a powerful medium. So this is one of the big mistakes when it comes to Paris. All of the other cities, you know, they're trying to combat all these protests. But in Paris, the arrogance of the French establishment leads them to make a massive mistake. They show images of these global riots on TV in the mistaken belief that it's going to show everyone the fine example of French strength and stability. All it does is galvanize the French youth into rebelling and taking to the streets and shouting for change. And you've got the French president, Charles de Gaulle, he thinks he's a progressive. He's been in power for 10 years, but he's been expanding the economy and he's invested in education by creating a new university in Nanterre, which is unfortunately situated in one of the slum areas of Paris. And that's where the protests begin. In the tear, this leads to the closure of the university, and then there's a domino effect as the protests spill out across towards the Sorbonne and into the city centre of Paris. And so on the 3rd of May 1968, the protesters clash with police for the first time, and viewers get to see it on TV. They see images of protesters swamped in clouds of tear gas, which apparently smelt vile, like bad eggs. And the police try and fail to get the crowds to disperse. And then by the middle of May, the protesters have occupied the universities. They've even taken over the Odeon Theatre, where the theatre administrator has actually joined the protesters on stage in solidarity. And still, de Gaulle refuses to resign. There are 30,000 people protesting in the city centre, and he refuses to resign. And then the cause is taken up by the trade unions, who are demanding higher wages, better working conditions, and more of a say in the way society is run. And they're also being sponsored and bolstered by various left-wing groups who, for a very short time, have realized that the best thing to do is to not fight each other. And they come together and they unite. And once all the factions unite, it looks like they've got a really good concerted effort. And then you'd think that that might cause trouble outside of the cities, but even though the infrastructure is damaged, so the trains aren't working, so the food can't get to and from the countryside, but there's a general feeling of support right across the country. There's like 500,000 people are unemployed. There's 2 million people on minimum wage. And then a general strike's called and 10 million workers withdraw their labor.
Wow.
And all this is going on while in the month that Robert Holmes is writing his first scripts for Doctor Who, which are delivered really quickly and without much need for change. And they're about the establishment suppressing the masses with education that they control, and they decide what they're allowed to do. And when the students express their dissatisfaction, they're threatened with hose-like weapons to disperse them. And you know, even it's not just Doctor Who is picking up on this. Like the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger saw the protest in London and wrote "Street Fighting Man." And then John Lennon's politics have always been a bit woolly at the best of times, but he writes "Revolution," and he likes it so much he writes it three times in three different ways and releases it in different formats. But he's really campaigning to get it to be a single, and the rest of the band aren't convinced. So it comes out as a B-side on Hey Jude. And the left hate him because he's attacking Chairman Mao and being critical of how woolly the left actually are when it comes to protest. And the right hate him because they don't feel that he's been strong enough. And then by the, I think it's about the middle of August, Soviet tanks roll into Czechoslovakia and that Prague Spring comes to an end and it all comes crashing down. So that's the background to, and although I'm being flippant and I've summarized it very specifically just to further the point, I think that is going on exactly at the time that Robert Holmes is writing his story. And the one thing that he adds to his original storyline from 3 years before is the student conflict. And he's not exactly on their side. He basically does take a patrician view of the doctor coming in to save the day. Celrus is an ineffective leader, but the Crotons need to be removed. So he's very much in charge in favor of regime change. But the students are idiots. They're completely ill-informed and ill-equipped to fight this battle. They're going to lose.
And you also mentioned the smell of tear gas, the rotten eggs, which is a detail that embeds itself into the story.
Yeah, yeah. I just think of, you know, a lot of stories at this point are using the smoke machine, but this particular story has got scenes of student unrest where the studio is filled with smoke. And there are hoses coming out of the establishment figure, which is the dinotrope. I don't think it's straining too hard for a reading there. I think it's quite an accurate one, which I didn't see back in 1994 or whenever it was.
And it's interesting trying to superimpose our current 2023 left-wing, right-wing dichotomy onto television of the late 1960s. As much as Star Trek is decried by certain people for being too political, late 60s Star Trek seasons 2 and 3 of the original series is what you would call liberal Republican, center right rather than left wing. You have the Way to Eden, where you have these space hippies who are disorganized and chaotic and do not come to a good end. And then you have a couple of episodes trying to grapple with the Vietnam War and coming to the conclusion, oh, the Vietnam War is a wonderful thing. Let's send more weapons. So Doctor Who, in the late 60s, you have The Dominators, which was made as part of season 5. So it was probably scripted in 1967 or 1968, not 1969. But The Dominators is a story that is a right-wing view of pacifism, and that's one of the reasons, well, one of the many reasons why The Dominators doesn't work for me. Can we decide if Robert Holmes was on anybody's side in the Crotons? Certainly he wasn't on the Croton side, but is this a left-wing story or a right-wing story or somebody who doesn't quite know what to make of events, so is just making fun of everybody in Vision?
I don't see Robert Holmes as a political animal in the same way that we will see Malcolm Hulk. I think he's just telling the story, but he's looking at the imagery and thinking, oh, that's interesting. Let's have the students as part of this. He's on their side in that he thinks they're oppressed, but he's not on their side in that he thinks that that their actions are going to have any effect. And he's kind of right. I mean, if you look at, I'm trying to think, the fact that the Crotons are overthrown, so the students win. But after de Gaulle gave in to some of the demands of the unions, the protests kind of calmed down. And if you speak to French people nowadays, they look at it with kind of embarrassment. They don't think it changed very much. And de Gaulle survived the challenge to his leadership for another year. And he was replaced as a president by his prime minister, Georges Pompidou, who'd already been in de Gaulle's cabinet for a decade, and he remained in office until his death, until in 1974, when he was replaced by Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, who'd previously been in de Gaulle's cabinet as well. So even after this supposed revolution, the establishment continued to rule for another decade until the socialist François Mitterrand was elected in 81. the point of all this is that by the end of the story, Selrys is dead, and the choice facing the Gonds is either ruthless pragmatism under Elec or a dynastic idealism with Selrys' son, Thara. So unless Beta suddenly starts to use his scientific awakening to stage a coup, which is unlikely, because if Beta was any good, he'd have been selected as a companion of the Crotons and killed off in the first scene, wouldn't he? When Thara concludes, we have to find our own answers, you just think, yeah, you're going to get invaded in a week, aren't you?
And you have the Grace note where Beta is played by James Cairncross, who was also the James Bondian spy in The Reign of Terror, but not quite playing the same role here 5 or 6 years down the road.
I mean, it gives you a little bit of hope. It's funny, when you look at a character, if they've got a sense of humor, you tend to look at them more favorably. So you've got a lot of, like Elec is a zealot, and Thara is an idealist, whereas Beta's funny. He sees how ridiculous the situation is, and he thinks, oh, well, let's make the most of it. The doctor said, well, let's try a bit of acid. Well, what if we try a lot of acid? Will that work? And sure enough, he's actually the one who provides the secret to the victory. But he's a bit of a bumbler. I think he's funny, so I quite like that character.
So looking at the Terence Dix novelization table of contents, many of these are generic chapter titles that we see in Terence books over and over again. The Rescue, The Rebels, The Attack, The Second Attack, Battle Plans. This is almost Terence Dix by ChatGPT. Hey, ChatGPT, give me 12 Terence Dix chapter titles. You'll have all that and Escape to Danger. The ones that I like are chapters 1, 11, and 12. Chapter 1 is A Candidate for Death. That is a terrific title for an opening chapter. Chapter 11, Elec's Bargain. This is the first appearance of Philip Madoc in proper Doctor Who, not counting his role as the Black Marketeer in the second American Dalek movie, Dalek Invasion of 2150. And then chapter 12, this goes back to the 1960s and the students. Acid. So Terence is dropping acid in the table of contents.
And of course, I was thinking about this in the 1990s, where suddenly acid was big again. there was a chart hit called Acid around about that time.
And this is one of Terence's shorter books. After some of the previous ones had gone to page 144, this one stops on page 121. It's only 115 pages. So Terence probably didn't have a lot more to add other than what his friend Bob Holmes would have put in the script. Not a whole lot of embellishment here. There's no world-building prologue. There's no, I think, memorable change from the TV. Robert Holmes is not the kind of writer that you need to, unless you're blunting some of his more offensive comments, there's not a whole lot that needs to be changed structurally, not a whole lot that needs to be apologized for.
Although Terence is not afraid to add some of his own, isn't he? There's that description of Varna, which is described as a slender, fair-haired young girl. Somehow her outstanding beauty made it hard to believe that she was among the most gifted of her generation of students, which is both... It's sexist, because he's kind of saying, well, you can't be pretty and smart. But he's also, as he often does, commenting on the actress, going, she's a bit dim, isn't she? So I can forgive him that, because I think it's, as ever, he's a bit wry. He's going, come on, Bob, this is a bit of old nonsense. Let's just spark it up a bit, you know. So he's he's got some lovely descriptions. Like he compares Selrys to a pillar. So on the one hand, it gives you straight away, you know, he's a grey-haired man in his 50s and he looks like a pillar. And you think, oh, well, that's like a pillar of the community. It's a pun in a way. But also he's unthinking. He's just standing there propping up the establishment. Well, actually, now I think of it, he's dressed as a Croton. He's dressed as a black Croton all the way through it with his little shoulder pads and everything. The whole design of him is very Croton-y.
We've already heard you do a dead-on impression of the Crotons earlier in this program. I think that for me, the Crotons work very well. Fraser Hines is making a second, or I'll say a third or fourth career, going to Doctor Who conventions. If there is a Doctor Who convention, Fraser Hines is at it. If Fraser Hines is at a Doctor Who convention, he will do a 1 or 2 hour panel talking about his time and commenting on the stories. And it's the same comments and the same anecdotes over and over again, because he's been doing this for a minute. When he talks about the Crotons, he will invariably make fun of the fact that the Crotons have no mobility. That's a good laugh line. I think in spite of that, I think the Crotons actually work better than we have a right to expect. Yes, when they're on location and it takes 20 minutes to walk in a straight line and it needs help, that perhaps is not Doctor Who's finest hour. But as they are standing still, these are impressive costumes. We can thank Roy Skelton. They have impressive voices. I think the Crotons are visually striking. And then you come to the cover of the novelization. If this is your first impression of a Croton, this glowing, translucent, crystalline beast, that's gorgeous.
It's beautiful, isn't it? And I love those pincers. I mean, usually in Doctor Who, something like that would bend as it tries to cup Fraser Hines' arm. You'd see it bending and looking a bit. They look very strong and very metallic. When he screams, you think that would leave a bruise. And I think it's a credit to David Maloney. The director really manages most of the time to avoid showing us the skirt.
Yes.
Because the rubber skirt does let it down, but that's, you know, in the book, Terence Dix at one point says that the Croton stepped out of the vat, and I'm thinking, did it? Did it really though? I don't see that happening with that skirt. I mean, I think it maybe stepped outside saddle from the vat, but the top half I think looks beautiful, and it's especially when you see it in low resolution on TV, and now we've got the beautiful vidfire thing, and you can see the detail. You can see the holes in the head, which of course are there for the operator to be able to breathe, but it just gives it a bit of extra detail, extra texture on the head. I think they're a gorgeous thing. And as I said, the voice and the sound of that room. Another thing is that they make that decision to have that soundscape and get Brian Hodgson in because he's cheap. It's not an artistic decision. It's just David Maloney going, we spent a lot on this. Can we just keep the cost down? And it ends up becoming this amazing thing.
The received wisdom on the Crotons, again, is that they are inept monsters with no mobility. The Crotons in-universe are meant to be scary. They have this planet under subjugation. They've been killing off generations of students looking for the brain power to emerge. The Crotons return in 1997 in Lawrence Miles's Alien Bodies. And there is an auction taking place on Earth in the 21st century. The auctioneer is a character who is possibly a returning Time Lord of dubious morals that we may have seen before in the 1970s on Doctor Who. Many terrifying alien species are invited to this auction to bid on a weapon. And we later learn that the weapon is the future Doctor's corpse. This, of course, springboards the idea of the Time War that has become so prevalent in the new series. The Daleks are invited to bid on this weapon. The Daleks do not show up because their ship is taken over and destroyed by the Crotons, who take the Daleks' place. We learn a lot about the Crotons, and you could expect that Lawrence Miles would be writing firmly tongue-in-cheek and making fun of them at every available opportunity. And he does have a couple of characters make fun of them after they emerge, but we learn that they are a mighty empire with prodigious weaponry who are capable of tremendous things, and they are only defeated because the Doctor does some clever bit of timey-wimeyness and manages to trap them. But the Crotons, if you take them seriously, they are an idea that works. And I will point out that we are still talking about the Hads 55 years later. In the second to last Doctor Who story that you and I have seen, and in the third to last Doctor Who story that my audience has seen, Wild Blue Yonder, the situation is so terrifying that the TARDIS leaves because of the Hads. The Hads is invented by Robert Holmes in this story, and then is not seen again on television until 55 years later. But the Crotons are meant to be frightening enough that the TARDIS goes nuts to this. I can't handle the Crotons. I'm out of here. So there is a reading of the Crotons as some of the scariest monsters the Doctor has ever faced, even if people only recall the execution of those monsters in studio and not the concept as written and as explored in universe. I think the Crotons work for me, and I don't laugh at them or mock them. And yes, parts of the story haven't aged well effect-wise, but what has aged well in the last 55 years effect-wise? I mean, come on.
When you look at, I mean, even the Daleks, you know, when they forget to put the modulation on full, like in the chase, and they sound a bit pathetic. Weirdly, I love the invasion, but the Cybermen voices sound a little bit more squeaky, sound a little bit more like a chipmunk, maybe.
They never could get a handle on what the Cybermen are supposed to sound like. My favorite cyber voice is the very first one, but that was ditched because nobody could understand what was happening in the 10th planet.
And then when you get